the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Here's your host, Jim Poplava.
Well, it is that time of the year, everybody's favorite time, when you have to sit and go over your records and take a look at filing your taxes. Well, there were a lot of things that went into effect last year, including stimulus, there were checks. What does all this mean from a tax point of view? Well, let's find out. Joining me on the program is tax specialist Dan Pilla. Dan, I want to begin with the PPP loans that were first given out by summer to a lot of businesses to keep their employees on payroll. Have they clarified how they are going to tax that? I know in my own state of California, California intends to tax PPP as income.
Well, there is a great deal of clarification on that, Jim, and I'm not sure California's got the legal standing to tax those things as income because they are loans for sure. I suppose they could take the position that if the loan is forgiven, then it becomes taxable income because that is the standard by which loans are determined to be income typically. But at the federal level, let's just talk about the federal level here for just a second. At the federal level, when you receive a PPP loan, because it's a loan on the front end, it is not taxable income when you receive it. When you use the PPP proceeds the way they are supposed to be used in accordance with the statute, there's specific ways the money has to be spent. As long as you spend the money in that fashion, you qualify for forgiveness. And if the loan is forgiveness, the CARES Act very specifically and expressly excludes the debt forgiveness from being income. All right, so you don't have to claim it as income on the front end because it's a loan. If it's forgiven, you don't claim it as income on the back end as long as it was used properly, and you won't get it forgiven if it's not used properly. All right, so now there's a third consideration at the federal level, and that is, can a business claim a deduction for the expenses they paid with their PPP money? The IRS initially took the position, Jim, back in August, that you could not claim a deduction for the expenses because it was free money on the front end. All right, that has been changed by law as part of the Consolidated Appropriations Act that passed Congress in December, was signed into law by former President Trump on December the 27th. It is absolutely crystal clear that you can use, or I should say that you can claim a deduction for the PPP money that was used to pay ordinary and necessary business expenses. In addition to that, Jim, there were a couple other things that happened with the PPP program as a result of that law, and that is that the scope of expenses that could be paid with PPP proceeds was expanded greatly. Started out at four narrow things, was increased to eight things. The PPP loan program was extended through March 31st, and Congress created what they call now a second draw loan program. So if you continue to struggle as a business, you can actually get a second PPP loan. So that's kind of the thumbnail sketch of what's going on at the federal level.
So given that, and we have a new administration in, Dan, there's been various proposals by the Biden administration. It seems like every president that comes in either raises or lower taxes. Bush lowered taxes. Obama raised them. Trump lowered them. And it looks like Biden's going to raise them. Can we talk about some of the things that are being considered, number one? And number two, how likely are all these things to be passed? Because you can wish for something if you're coming in as a president, but you may not always get what you wish for.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Jim. And ordinarily, there is required some level of persuasion by a president to convince those on the other side of the aisle that they should go along with whatever the proposal should be. In this case, Biden doesn't have to do any persuading at all that I can see because he controls both the House and the Senate. And we've got some pretty dyed-in-the-wool liberals in both houses of Congress that are controlling what's going on there, and Nancy Pelosi chief among them, and so I don't know that Biden's going to have too much persuading that he's going to have to do. The question is how much of a radical change in tax policy is he willing to make? First of all, the threshold proposal for the Biden administration is a couple of things. First of all, is to repeal the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was the Trump Tax Act that was passed in 2017, took effect in 2018. It was widely regarded by the left as tax cuts for the rich. That is a demonstrably false allegation. It was not tax cuts for the rich. The fact of the matter is, and this was fully documented by every organization that did an objective study, including my own study, including the Brookings Institute, by the way, had to confess that the actual consequences of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act were exactly what the Trump administration purported they would be, and that is tax cuts for everybody in the lowest 80% of the income bracket. So in other words, it was only the top 20% of income earners that either saw no tax increase or saw a tax increase under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Everybody else got a tax cut, and the majority, the bulk of those cuts were for folks between the $40,000 to $80,000 income level, what we would call the heart of the middle class. So the allegation that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was tax cuts for the rich is demonstrably false, and yet Biden has promised to repeal that. And so if he repeals that in its entirety, there's going to be there's going to be a whole laundry list of significant consequences. But the two things at the top of my list are, number one, the repeal of the qualified business income tax deduction that was part of that act, which gave a 20% tax deduction, Jim, for all businesses under 425, I think 425 or 435 was the cap. Might have been even less than that. Might have been 415. Under that, you got no benefit of this qualified business income deduction for everybody, which of course is the bulk of the small business owners. Up to that level, got a 20% deduction equivalent to 20% of their business net business income, which is huge, huge for small businesses. All right. The other thing that changes is the corporate tax rate goes from 21% back to 35%, which is what it was under Obama. And who knows, Jim, how much farther north it'll go than 35%. But the troubling part of the 35% corporate tax bracket is that it is the highest corporate income tax bracket in the industrialized world, which is one of the reasons why so much capital fled America during the last, if you go back to 2016, the 20, 25 years previous to that, so much trillions of dollars in capital fled the United States precisely because of this high corporate tax rate. And so if we return to that policy, you know, you're going to have another mass exodus of corporate capital, I would expect.
So when you take a look at these tax rates that they're talking about, and this is something I'm glad you brought up, because the media distorted the Trump tax cuts because a good majority of it happened at the lower level. And you can see this if you can compare where the tax rates start on what level of income, just compare that side by side with the Obama rate. So let me ask you, if they are talking about, Dan, doing a stimulus again, Biden, they passed $900 billion under Trump just before he left office, and now Biden's talking about $1.9 trillion to stimulate the economy, and then possibly another $2 trillion on top of that with infrastructure. But if you're going to inject trillions of dollars into the economy to stimulate it, aren't you defeating it if you then turn around and then raise taxes?
Well, yeah, there's no question about it. Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. That is just an undeniable fact. But listen, it is a matter of documentable historical fact that the more you raise tax rates, the less revenue you collect. This is an empirical fact that can be proven. Every time there was marginal tax cuts at all levels, particularly the highest income level, it generates economic activity, which creates revenue for the government. All right, this is just simply undeniable. Every time you increase rates, you reduce revenue flow to the government. So I guess the question is, what is the purpose? What is the underlying purpose of taxes? All right, the central purpose of a tax, Jim, has only had ever one historical historical purpose, and certainly I would argue there's only one constitutional purpose for taxes, and that is to raise revenue to fund the legitimate functions of government. If that's what we want to do, if we agree that we need to raise revenue to fund the legitimate functions of government, then those rates have to be kept low at all levels, particularly the high levels. Now, I'm not saying that higher income people should pay at a lower rate than lower income people, but certainly the current rates are way too high, and Biden will increase them yet again, push them back up to the highest rate at was 39.5% before Trump, and who knows what it'll be when Biden's done. As far as I'm concerned, there's no rate for these people that's too high. But the fact of the matter is, Jim, when you increase rates, you decrease revenue. Because here's what they can't seem to wrap their heads around, and that is that tax rates have an effect on behavior. People act in accordance with their own best interests based on their pocketbook. And so if you punish people, or let me rephrase that and say, if you impose upon people high tax burdens for taking financial risk, guess what? They aren't going to take as much financial risk. They're going to go places where their money is safer. They're going to go places where their money is tax exempt, like municipal bonds. And so what happens is you've got all this capital that gets locked up into these non-productive, or at least not as productive, investments where they would be far more productive in the marketplace in terms of creating jobs and building infrastructure and all these various things that go along with capital investment. All of that stuff is tamped down, it's chilled when you have high tax rates. The higher the rate, the more chilling effect on this economic behavior.
You know, it's amazing because I've read a lot of these same studies, Dan, where you raise tax rates. Historically, there's a certain percentage of GDP that the government takes in tax revenues. And it doesn't matter if they raise the rates, they don't get more. And that's something you would think that somebody at Treasury or the IRS would explain that to those in Congress.
Well, I guess I can't answer for Treasury or those in the IRS. And first of all, people in the IRS, I'll just say this. People in the IRS have no concern whatsoever for economic consequences of the tax laws. Their job simply is to enforce the palette of laws that is handed to them by Congress. So I'm not surprised that nothing's coming out of the IRS in this respect. But you're right about the Treasury, Jim. There's no question that the data that I talk about, when I talk about these historical facts, is all Treasury data. The United States Department of Treasury produces a document every quarter called Statistics of Income. All right, so Jim, when you want to curl up in front of your fireplace and do some great reading, get yourself a copy of the Statistics of Income Bulletin produced by the IRS. It's usually a booklet that's 8.5 by 11 in size. As I said, it comes out quarterly. If you printed it out, it'd be 200 or 300 pages per issue. And you want to read Treasury data, you can knock yourself out. And all of this stuff is in there for anybody to read. And these days with the internet, we used to have to get this information. 30 years ago, we used to have to get this information by writing the IRS a letter and asking for documents and requesting Freedom of Information Act and all that nonsense. Now you have this stuff literally in 15 seconds with a couple dozen keystrokes on your computer. You'll have it downloaded to your computer and you can start reading the stuff by the time the show's over with. The point is, this data is available for anybody to look at. And the problem is, precious few people look at it.
So when you look at this, they repeat the same mistake. And it seems to be a political football, Dan. One administration raises, the next administration comes in and lowers. And it's this political football. Let's talk about the implications for planning, because if you're a business and you're trying to plan, you're doing your budget, you have to factor in taxes, capital expenditures. How does one plan for this? And the reason I say this, Dan, I remember with the Bush tax cuts, they sunsetted in 2010, just like had Trump won a second term, his tax cuts would have sunsetted in 2025. And I think back to 2010, when the Bush tax cuts sunsetted, that was a year we actually had zero estate taxes because they didn't come up with a solution. And I recall George Steinbrenner passed away that year with a multi-billion dollar estate and paid no estate taxes just because of the quirks in the law. So how does one plan when they're constantly changing these rules?
Well, Jim, you just put your finger on one of the most nefarious aspects of our tax system and what it has devolved into over the last 40 years. One of the 10 most basic principles of sound tax policy is the principle of stability. A tax system has to be stable precisely for the reasons you just articulate. People have a right to plan their affairs, to understand from day to day, from year to year, what their tax responsibilities are. And you cannot do that under the tax system we have now. Let me give you a statistic here that might shock you. The Internal Revenue Code was changed more than 5,900 times just since 2001 alone, and that does not include the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. It does not include the Consolidated Appropriations Act and the various other minor things that were, quote-unquote, minor tax laws that were passed along the way. So we're talking about well over the Consolidated Appropriations Act, Jim, as you probably know, was 5,593 pages long. Now, in fairness, not all of it was income tax changes, but a good portion of it was. I haven't counted it up, but I'm still going through it. I don't know about you, but I'm still working my way through it. So these are massive tax law changes that go on and on and on. Congress is constantly stirring the pot, just like you said, political football going back and forth. And this does not serve the interests of the American people. It does not serve the interests of American businesses. We need a stable tax system so people know what the law is. So what the law is today, we know the law is going to be tomorrow. The law is going to be that way next year. It's going to be that way in 5 years. People have a right, Jim. It's a fundamental right to due process of law under the United States Constitution to know what the law requires of them so they've got a meaningful opportunity to comply with that law in a responsible way. When you've got the law that's changing constantly, people can't do that.
And when you have something like this, and as you mentioned, when taxes are raised, they get less revenue because people change behavior. I see this all the time in my practice, Dan. If they raise the tax laws, we do things like Roth conversions. We do tax-free bonds. We do tax shelters, charitable remainder trusts, foundations. So people that have the means and wealth aren't just going to sit there and lay down and just say, okay, just take my money. They're going to do something to preserve it.
Yeah, there's no question about it. That's absolutely true. It's human nature, and it's 100% predictable that if you punish somebody for taking specific action, fewer people are going to take that action. If you reward people for taking certain other action, a good share of people are going to take the action that leads to rewards. This is how we discipline children, for heaven's sakes. We teach our kids this. By the time they're 5 years old, they understand this concept of bad behavior produces bad results and good behavior produces good results. All right, there's just no question about that. And here's the conclusion I've come to, Jim, is not that those on the left don't understand this. They do. Those on the left have a different philosophy of taxation, which is fundamentally different from the constitutional model. Now, this is just me talking. This is just my opinion. It's not my opinion about the Constitution. The Constitution lays out a very narrow scope of authority for using the taxing power of the United States Congress. They can use the power for very, very narrow purposes, all right? And those purposes are basically to fund the legitimate functions of government, all right? So the purpose of taxation is to raise revenue to fund the legitimate functions of government. Those on the left use taxes for a different purpose, all right? And they use taxes, and I call them tax theologians, Jim. In other words, they have this tax. Their tax policy is driven, if you'll excuse the expression, by more of a religious philosophy than a legal philosophy. They want to impose tax burdens for the sake of taxes. They want taxes for the sake of taxes, not for the purposes of raising revenue to fund the government. They want taxes as a means to punish people that they think somehow should not be as successful as they are. So there is no constitutional authority, Jim, for the federal government to use the power of for Congress to use the the constitutional power of taxation to punish people simply because they might be more successful financially than somebody else. That is an illegitimate use of the taxing power, and that's where the left's focus is, and that's why we have this religious dedication to high tax rates, even though they know they don't raise revenue.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because you take a look at some of these tax rates, and it's just, you know, psychologically, who would want to work if over 70% of what you make goes to the government in one form of taxes or another? And that's why, because if you take a look at some of the Biden tax proposals, number one, they would get rid of the Trump tax bill, which would raise a lot of taxes on lower income people. But it would raise the tax rates, let's just round it off to 40%. In my own state of California, you have 13.3, so you're at 53.3. And then on top of that, Biden would add Social Security taxes on anybody making over 400. So if you're self-employed, add another 15.3 to that. Dan, you're over 70%.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely correct, and it's confiscatory, Jim, at that point. And as you know, as a matter of fact, we had rates that were as high as 93%. We're talking about marginal rates as high as 93% in the 1960s. And one of the things that John F. Kennedy did was lower tax rates, precisely under the theory that the higher rates are chilling economic activity and reducing revenue at those high income rates. And the rates were slashed considerably at that time, which produced a tremendous amount of revenue during the 1960s and created economic stability going forward into the late 1970s. 20 years of economic growth and stability was essentially changed under the Carter administration in the late 1970s. As you probably, I don't know how old you are, maybe you remember that, maybe you don't. But the point is this, that it is absolutely empirically provable that the higher the rate, the less economic activity and the more stagnation you get.
So what are you telling your clients right now, Dan, given the fact that we have a new administration, you've got the Democrats talking about raising taxes, Biden has a tax plan that would raise taxes substantially. So, you know, who knows whether it's going to get passed in terms of what he wants, but what are you telling your clients to do right now?
Well, I mean, first of all, the vast majority of my clients are already in trouble with the IRS, and so I'm focusing on getting them out of the soup. But as far as small businesses are concerned going forward, Jim, look, at it's difficult to plan. What are you telling them? I'm telling them, if they've got a PPP loan, they got to make sure that they got the records to document what it is. If they intend to go back and get another PPP loan, okay, fine. Make sure that you understand how the money can be spent and make sure that you can document how you spent the money as far as planning is concerned. I don't know what the answer is, Jim, because the fact of the matter is we're still operating under a pandemic national emergency. We still have lockdowns all across the country. You're in California. I don't have to tell you about lockdowns. It is very, very, I had a small business client in here yesterday that's shrugging his shoulders and has lost about $30,000 a month in revenue because of his clients shutting down their operations, and he's not able to go in and serve them under ordinary circumstances. So he's having to let his employees go, and he's shrugging his shoulders, and he's telling me, I don't know if I'm ever going to go back to having the number of employees that I've had in the past because it's such a hassle dealing with the tax consequences of all these doggone employees. I mean, I can't tell you, Jim, how many small business people I've talked to over the last, I don't know, let's just say 5 years that say, you know what, I'm never going to have another employee again with all of the hassle and anxiety that goes along with the tax compliance burdens that are heaped on employers that are heaped on businesses that have employees. It's monstrous. And so what do you tell these people to do? I'm at a loss as far as that's concerned.
Well, you have another issue too, because they're talking about a minimum wage of $15. And the worst thing that you could do right now to a restaurant owner who's been shut down most of the year or now can only operate at 25% capacity is to tell them you're going to raise their cost of doing business by raising the minimum wage to $15. A lot of restaurants, you're seeing this in the fast food places, they're going to automation. So they're replacing workers with machines.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And there's no question about it. The minimum wage laws have always had a negative effect on employment. There's no question about that. And you know, and I question the constitutional authority of the federal government to issue minimum wage directives in the first place. Where's the constitutional authority for that? The United States Constitution very specifically takes away from Congress any ability to interfere with the obligation of a contract. But, you know, they don't seem to care about that either, Jim. Now, certainly states can do that. States have the power to come along and say, well, there should be this minimum wage or that minimum wage under the circumstances, but the federal government has no such authority. And you're exactly right. You know, listen, here is the economic realities that people need to wrap their heads around, Jim, and that is what you tax, you get less of, and what you subsidize, you get more of. All right. So a minimum wage is a form of a tax on the employer for hiring workers. This is just exactly what it is. It's going to cost you X dollars to hire that worker. Okay, fine. If you're going to require me to pay $15 an hour to workers, guess what? I only have so much money budgeted for my payroll objectives here in my budget. Right. I'm going to budget X dollars for that. Now, if I get five employees out of that budget, that's one thing. If the minimum wage goes up, maybe I got to reduce to 4 employees, or maybe I got to reduce to 3 employees. All right, the employer, the business has a budget for labor, and they're going to have to cram their available labor into that budget. And so when you raise the minimum wage, you simply reduce the number of people available to work under that budget. Jim, it's just economic reality that these people don't wrap their heads around.
Given the fact there's a lot of uncertainty ahead, it just means that, you know, it's going to be very, very difficult to plan. And I wonder, Dan, how much of that impacts economic growth? In other words, if you're a business, you could be a restaurant, you could be a gym owner, or, you know, you run a hair salon or nail salon. How do you plan a business when you're not really sure what the tax laws are going to be? So some of this has got to be impacting the economy and economic growth.
Yeah, there's no question about it. You can't plan your business. I mean, we didn't even get to all of the capital gains issues, but you know, one of the things that Biden is talking about, believe it or not, is using mark to market accounting on capital assets. And what that means very simply is that right now under the capital gains laws, you don't realize a gain or loss. You don't recognize a gain or loss on your capital asset transactions until it's sold. All right. So if you buy a stock for $10 and the stock goes to $100, okay, that's fine. But that $100 is unrecognized gain unless you sell it. If we go to mark-to-market accounting for capital assets, that means you're going to have to report the value of those assets every year and pay tax on the gain, even though you haven't sold the assets. Well, Jim, under what circumstances is a business going to make substantial investments in equipment and inventory, not inventory, but equipment and facilities, if they've got to mark the value of those assets to the market every year and pay a doggone capital gains tax on this stuff every year they own the equipment? God, can you imagine what that's going to do to businesses?
Oh, it's kind of crazy, but you know, nonetheless, they're talking about it. Well, listen, Dan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work or get in touch with you, how could they do so, please?
Yeah, very simply, go to taxhelponline.com. It's all one word, no spaces, taxhelponline.com. And my latest book is called Dan Pilla's Small Business Tax Guide. It's available right there on the internet, taxhelponline.com. Jim, that's where they go.
All right. Well, listen, Dan, thanks for coming on the program. So the word is be prepared, because it looks like more changes are coming. Dan, take care and come back again.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.